Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to Justice with me, prison philanthropist and founder of One Small Thing, Edwina Grosvenor. In the series of Justice, we will explore the experiences of mothers in the justice system, from women who enter prison pregnant and give birth inside, to those who are separated from their children for imprisonment and involvement from social services. Each episode, I'll be speaking to expert guests and exploring what needs to change. This week on Justice, we explore the experiences of Black and racially minoritised mothers in the justice system. I speak to Dr. Sinem Bozkurt and Monica Thomas, two researchers at the cutting edge of improving knowledge on how race intersects with motherhood experiences in the justice system.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sinem Bozkurt. I'm a lecturer in criminology at the University of Westminster.
Hi, I'm Monica Thomas. I'm a teaching fellow in criminology at the University of Bath Spa and also a PhD research candidate at Cardiff University.
So thank you both so much for being with me today. What I really want to do is put a little bit of a spotlight actually onto improving knowledge on the experience of racially minoritized mothers. I think so much of the conversations we have around mother and baby units and mothers who are sent to prison are predominantly seen through the eyes of white people, if I'm going to be blunt. So Monica, if I can come to you first, can you give me a bit of a, I guess, a bird's eye view of the issues and some of the work that you've been undertaking?
Yeah, sure. So my PhD research is focused on Black mothers' experiences in and after imprisonment. So I conducted Black feminist narrative interviews with 9 Black mothers who had lived experience of imprisonment. Some of those mothers were currently in prison at the time when I spoke to them, and some of them had since been released and were living back in the community. And I would say, to summarise everything in a short sort of sentence, I suppose, would be the way in which experiences of racialisation and racism intersected with experiences of motherhood. So it wasn't necessarily that there were huge differences between, I suppose, the research we already know about, the trauma of separation from children, the pressures of being, I suppose, watched and surveyed on a mother and baby unit, but the way in which racism intersects with those experiences. So the weight of being racialised as Black and the stereotypes, I suppose, that surround Black femininity, you know, that Black women are often viewed through lenses, when we view Black women through the lens, I suppose, of whiteness, violent, aggressive, and the way that impacts, I suppose, on motherhood then.
Yeah, so like the stereotyping.
Yeah, so one of the mothers I spoke to, she said, I can't remember her exact quote off the top of my head, but she sort of expressed how society viewed Black women as an angry Black woman. And she said, and that means you're up against it before you've even opened your mouth in the prison system.
It's kind of like people, yeah, waiting for you to be violent.
Yes, and that her language, her bodily movements and things, she felt that that was interpreted through that lens at all times. And she was sort of hyper aware, that sort of hyper awareness, I suppose, of the stereotypes that had been sort of placed on her body and on her experiences in that environment.
Yeah. And can you tell me a little bit maybe about, because lots of people listening won't necessarily even understand the prison system. So yes, we've got lots of prisons, only 12 of them are women's. And within those 12 women's prisons, we've got, is it 6 mother and baby units?
Yes. There were some that weren't fully functioning for a time, but I believe we're back up to sort of 6 functioning ones.
And then women can apply.
Yes.
To get a place if they're pregnant when they're sentenced to custody. And do you know what percentage, maybe not, I don't know if you know this, what percentage would be Black mothers?
So we don't have statistics on the amount of mothers that are in prison anyway. It's estimated it's around 66% of mothers. So to then break that down by race, that hasn't been done yet because we're not even collecting data on how many mothers there are just in general. So
Sinem, you looked like you were
I totally agree with her. Yeah. I totally agree with her. And I'd say off the top of my head, a very, very small minority, if that's, because if I go by Bronzefield, to put it into perspective, there's 20 mother and baby units, 20 spaces in the mother and baby units, I believe. And there's about over 1,000 women in custody, many of them pregnant, many of them with young children, and how many of them are going to get that place. And if we are going to, because if we are going to choose between them, is it really going to be that black mother that gets it?
And your work is looking at which different groups?
All different groups. So mine is racially minoritized groups as a whole.
Okay. And can you sort of drill into that a bit more? Give us more of a picture. I know, if you can manage.
That it's a bit more complex because, well, I didn't actually know that it was going to end up being so complex, but I interviewed 8 mothers, all from different backgrounds, belonging to different religious groups. And I ended up with masses of data with completely different issues, completely different requirements. You know, for example, as Monica said, I also found with black mothers, there was the issue of them being deemed as boisterous and they were subjected to racism. But then I found with Muslim women, it was their religion that was at the forefront and then their appearance to an extent. So some of them had to kind of change the way they look, take off the hijab maybe. But then for the others that were, could probably blend in as white, but actually aren't white, you know, aren't the Anglo-Saxon white. So we're talking about Greek and travellers and stuff. That for them, their ethnicity was an issue. So it's a wide range of issues. And as Monica said, it's just the intersecting factor, you know, not to look at them, not to look at each factor on its own, but to combine them and to see how women experience this. And that's when it becomes way too complex to kind of start unravelling.
Yeah. So give me some more examples. If I was a woman coming into a mother and baby unit and it might have different cultures or practices around breastfeeding or the way that things are done that we all know we sort of do when we have a baby to a certain extent within parameters, because we all do things still slightly differently, don't we?
Yeah, I think I'd focus on the cultural elements there, because they, let alone with their children in the mother and baby unit, they can't really get everything they need within the prison just for themselves anyway. So to then go to the mother and baby unit with their child. 2 women I interviewed, one was from Pakistan, I believe. She was in the mother and baby unit and she spoke a lot about not being able to feed her child the food that they would normally do traditionally at home. And, you know, that her child really didn't fit in because it was majority white. The children and the other mothers. So it was very difficult in that sense. Blending in was almost impossible.
And how old was that child?
10 months.
Roughly. Right, okay.
Yeah, so you can stay up to 18 months, I believe. The child can be up to 18 mm-hmm. months on a mother and baby unit in England and Wales.
Right.
Well, English prisons, because there's no women's prisons in Wales, but you know what I mean.
And this is just giving these examples without even touching on the racial discrimination they suffer from staff.
One of the mothers I spoke with had experience on a mother and baby unit. And again, it just came back to that feeling of over-surveillance, sort of the pressure to appear as if you're coping out of fear that not coping might mean you're separated from your child, for example. And if you think about how stressful that period of time is once you've had a baby and feeling as if, you know, you're being watched to see if you're doing everything okay and you're appearing as, I suppose, that perfect mother or that good, inverted commas, that good mother. And we know sort of who has easier access to good mothering sort of narratives already. So what that means then when you've got the weight of what you've already experienced in the wider prison system and the stereotypes that you've sort of experienced being placed upon you going into that environment, which is almost a lot more pressure, I suppose, it was quite traumatic mm-hmm. for the mother I spoke to.
Yeah, women can be moved there with their baby, can't they? Or they can be on a mother and baby unit pregnant waiting to give birth.
No, they will go to the mother and baby unit after giving birth.
Okay.
Or a couple of weeks.
Maybe just, before,
But usually
just about.
Yeah. You wouldn't be on there just
waiting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think it's a good place to shout out people like birth companions, actually. Some of the mothers I spoke with, they said if it sort of wasn't for birth companions, they don't think they would have known their rights as pregnant mothers. They wouldn't have had access to the support that they needed. And a lot of them said, the support wasn't coming from the prison itself. It was coming from those external sort of organisations who
charitable
were going in.
Charitable organisations that work inside the prisons on behalf of the mothers. And what about the group of travellers that you have done a bit of research into as well, sort of within your
work? I spoke to one traveller mother. Travellers were the most difficult people to get hold of to talk they very, very difficult as a community.
So within the prison or outside the prison now?
I didn't interview women in prison. I spoke to them once they were released, and traveller women were not very keen to come forward. But the one that did come forward, she actually explained that it was more so because of how they're stereotyped in community, how they're never liked. So it was very difficult. It took a lot for them to even identify as a traveller. So from the, particularly from entry into prison, she said one particular thing that she tried her best to avoid was to be identified as a traveller woman, because she just believed that they would treat her differently. You know, she said, we're visibly different. You know, we have long hair and we dress differently. And once the prison service become aware of this, they are more likely to discriminate against us. And she felt throughout her sentence that she was always discriminated against. I think one thing with her, and generally travellers I found in the research, is that they are more accepting of each other within their community. So a woman that has committed an offence, or a mother that has committed an offence, is more readily accepted back into the home, back into the community, and they can snap back into mothering. So different, you know, completely different from other cultures and religions. But then they have this external issue with the wider society where they're a traveller, and then the fact that they've got a conviction in addition to this. So she did struggle a lot, particularly with finding employment. But other than that, family-wise and her children, she was very happy throughout.
So whilst all the mothers I spoke to self-identified as Black or Black mixed race, I did take a sort of, I suppose, intersectional approach. Most of the mothers I spoke to were British, but not all of them were. So some of the mothers I spoke to who did not have, I suppose, British citizenship had very particular experiences that I saw, the intersections, I suppose, between the prison system and the immigration system, and how that, I suppose, shapes experience in a different way to perhaps a British mother, a Black British mother in the prison system. Colourism came up as well. So the difference, I suppose, between what the women I spoke to term sort of dark-skinned and light-skinned Black women, that those who identified as having darker skin felt that they were treated differently to Black women with lighter skin or Black mixed-race women. Class as well came into it. One of the mothers spoke about how she was quite used to being within middle-class circles and speaking and carrying herself in a certain way, and she felt that that had enabled her to progress to open conditions a bit more quickly, whereas other mothers sort of said that the prison environment and the sort of standards that were expected of the women and how to carry themselves, she wasn't used to speaking to staff in a particular way, and she didn't know how to communicate with them. So there was something classed happening as well. Again, I spoke to mothers who identified as bisexual and felt that they had different experiences based on that. So not one mother's experience was the same who I spoke to.
And country of origin, right?
Yeah. I suppose the stereotypes placed on language and who has access to certain language and jargon. I think one of the mothers actually called it jargon as well. Like, I don't know how to speak their jargon. And it's like, I don't know how to almost get on with these people in order to progress, because progression is at the discretion, I suppose, of the staff a lot of the time. And that has implications for people who aren't able to play the game, I suppose.
Definitely. And if you have a staff that's slightly biased or have deep down has the racist thoughts, then, you know, even if you play the game, it's their discretion. It's totally down to them.
And I
also found that with actually the traveller woman said, you know, as no matter how hard I try, I was never given an enhanced status, which is obviously a higher status in prison. She said I could never make sense of why, because I'd done all the right courses, I'd done everything they ever asked me to, I always, you know, followed the rules, and I was never granted it. And that's what made me think, you know, it's their discretion.
Yeah. And I found basically the same thing, that either women didn't understand why they never got to open conditions, or why it took so long to get there enhanced, or why it took so long to get to open conditions. And I guess it's sort of the racial bias playing into that. But then that has implications for motherhood, because if you're not getting your enhanced status, if you're not accessing open conditions, those are the things that enable you to get closer to your children and to be reconnected with them more quickly.
Definitely. Even if you were to stay in closed conditions, I think that's the difference between having weekly visits and fortnightly visits. So and having more money on your canteen, which means you can get more phone credit. So actually, it's a major difference when you are in prison. It definitely has to be multi-agency. We can't just put all the pressure on prisons to deal with everything. And during the imprisonment, yes, you may help the individual in need, but then post-release, what happens when you drop them outside of that gate with their see-through bag and £46 grant? Where do they go? What do they do? Many women as you said, lose their children walking into custody and post-release. To get their children back, they need to be housed. To be housed, they need their children back. So what the hell is happening here?
And we also know about systematic racism in housing, in the housing sector.
And if you've got a conviction, that's an addition to it. So there's so many layers to it. And this applies to men as well, of course. But as we said, you know, women are generally primary carers. So in terms of children, it's the mother is generally more impacted.
The majority of the mothers I spoke to after release struggled to find people to support them, to find housing. I say they struggled. Really, it wasn't their struggle. They just didn't have people to support them to find housing. A lot of the women I spoke to experienced homelessness, not necessarily having to be on the street, but homelessness all the same. And, you know, there is statistical data. I think Shelter have quite a number of reports around sort of systematic racism in housing and the different sort of levels of accessibility of housing for different groups. And I think I wouldn't have those statistics off the top of my head.
The double discrimination as well. So if you've walked out of prison and you're looking for housing, you have to declare your conviction. That alone, it makes it difficult. So then in addition to the conviction, if you are a Black individual, that's double discrimination or double difficulty, let's say. It's not direct discrimination. But then if you also add that this is a woman and, you know, women that are convicted are generally kind of like thrown away in the eyes of society.
Because the
stigma is heightened to the Muslim women. Their children were almost suffering. Their children were carrying the burden of the imprisonment.
Okay, so you're talking about the mothers who are inside the prison and the children who are left on the outside.
Yes. So, and I actually, once analysing, I found that it's the female children that suffer the most. They carry the stigma, they carry the shame of that, of the mother's imprisonment. Not so much the boys. So the mothers, when they were talking about the boys, it was more like, you know, yeah, maybe they struggled in school and they didn't do well with their GCSEs or their primary school. But with the girls, it was, you know, her marriage broke down and people don't want to associate with her. And they've been talking, you know, that's her daughter. So it was a lot of cultural shame that was laying on the daughter as much as the mother. And again, it was very, very different for all of the mothers and all of the children as well.
The mothers in mine didn't necessarily, I think some did mention stigma and things, but there was also a concern of their children being criminalised and the potential of that moving forward. I think one of the mothers spoke about how going to prison, increases the risk. I mean, I don't use language like risk and things, but she sort of said it increases the risk of her child going to prison now.
Yeah, yeah. And those are real stats, aren't there? There is a bit of data around that.
Especially with sort of Black and Black mixed race children. I think about over 40%, they account for children racialized as Black or mixed or Black mixed race account for around 40% of the youth prison system, which is huge. If you know, Black people in general account for around 3% of the population, so that's almost half the prison population in youth custody being Black or Black mixed race. And some of the mothers talked to me about how they sort of began to mother in particular ways, in quite strategic ways, in order to try and mitigate against, again, I'm using the word risk, and I don't like the word risk, but to mitigate against that sort of potential of the criminalisation of their children. So it was a fear. It was quite an apparent fear.
And the reality is, if you're a single mum and you're taken to prison, well then, you know, the children often don't have a father to stay with, right? And sometimes they don't have a grandparent to go
it's
to either.
Like something like 95% of...
Yep. So only 5% stay in their family home, but the remaining 95%, there's actually no stats to show us where they go. But this was collected in 1997, so actually we're very slow with, we don't have any figures today.
Wow.
We don't know much about the children.
Just a complete oversight in terms of motherhood and race.
It is, and I think the probably one of the main reasons is that we only have about 4,000 to 5,000 women in custody, so they almost don't grant that kind of attention. We focus heavily on men and all the studies are male dominated. So I think that's one of the major issues.
Yeah, in my research, the majority of the mother's children stayed with family members or fathers. So there was sort of a network of support. And it was often multiple family members actually involved in childcare. Mm. So it wasn't, even if the child was staying just in one household to sort of sleep and live, there was actually this sort of network of support of people being involved in all the different daily childhood routines, I suppose. I thought that was quite good. And the mothers often spoke with quite sort of joy and things about the fact that their children were able to stay in the family.
Yeah, I bet.
And be cared for by people they knew and trusted. Obviously not the case for all the mothers I spoke with, but I would say the majority for me in my research, which might not be represented in other studies, obviously.
Yeah, there was a Muslim lady who I know very well, and she went to prison, had four children removed off her. It was first time offence, non-violent, and she was given 4 years. It was sort of one of those examples that's just really horrific and a complete travesty, actually. And her children were put into care, but because they sort of didn't really care, they were like, well, she's just sort of brown, she's sort of Asian. And so they placed the children with a Sikh family. And she talked so sort of emotionally about how that was and how they didn't even bother to ask her. They just looked at her and were like, oh, you're all sort of brown, so therefore it...
You know. Actually, one of the women I spoke to had that experience when she was born. She was mixed race, so her mum didn't want her because she said, this is in her own words, she wasn't white enough. Her dad didn't want her because she wasn't black enough. And they both actually had their own families and this was an affair. And so she grew up with she was adopted by a white family. And she said that growing up, she never fit in because she was in a white area with a white family and she was very visibly darker than them. And then once she was in prison, she had three children who were taken into care. And that was her main worry that, you know, they're going to be adopted into families. They're never going to know who they are. And she wasn't able to have any contact with them, although her offence was not related to her children in any way or form. So there was no question of her parenting, you know. And you find that with a lot of women, it's not that they're bad mothers or they've done something wrong to their children, but, you know, they are very quick to grab the children off them. And I guess it just makes it worse.
Absolutely. In fact, that's exactly what happened to this lady who I was mentioning. She'd sort of always been a good mother and she was put on parenting courses and, you know, and she said she found that really intolerable because her abusive husband, who had coerced her into a fraud because she looked nice and was sort of friendly and intelligent. You know, it was nothing to do with the children at all. In fact, she was often trying to protect the children from the abusive father. And then she said, did he ever get to do any parenting courses? No. And he wasn't sent to prison. And
I mean, generally dads are, you know, if it's a single parent and the dad is doing his weekly, you know, turning up and picking the child up for half an hour, he's an amazing dad. We automatically accept that he's done such a good job. He's, you know, come to see the child, taking him to the park. But whereas the mother, having the 24-hour duty goes completely unnoticed.
Yeah, it's so true, isn't it?
Because she has to do this anyway.
Yeah.
But he's a good dad because he turned up for 10 minutes, you know.
Yeah, even with my friends and sort of in my sort of rosy world. And, you know, you'll see a dad with three kids in the park and people are like, did you see so-and-so?
Yeah.
He went out with the three kids and I sometimes even forget and find myself going, oh, wow, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go, hold on a minute.
He's supposed to.
We do that all the time.
Exactly. He's supposed
it's
to.
It's called parenting.
Exactly.
It's
but I don't even want to call it a burden, but that lays more on the mother. Actually, it lays completely on the mother. It's like dad can be there by choice. You know, if he's there, it's a good thing. If not, then, oh, well, you know. The mother has to get on with it. And actually, I was going to add with where I talked about the kind of women that were talking about being burdened by their culture, even though, just like you said, their children were also in a huge family network at times and there was, you know, multiple people caring for them. They, however, weren't allowed to be in contact with the mum because of what she's done, because of this cultural stigma. So you'd find that a lot of the women weren't able to talk to their children. So even though they knew that they were at home, and sometimes they were at home with the abusive men that these women have escaped. So because, you know, it's when we say domestic violence in certain cultures, it's not just the violence of an intimate partner. It's the violence of the father. It's the violence of the father-in-law or any other male member that is kind of allowed to govern the women. And children are often left in their hands, which just heightens the anxiety of the mother of, you know, how is my child and what is actually happening out there?
Yeah. Another element is the fact that when a child is removed off a parent in the family court, there's money that goes with that child, right, for its care. And when a child is separated from its mother, if the mother goes to prison, say there's three little boys left and they have to go and stay with their grandmother. There's no money that goes with those children.
And that, I was going to say, I know I said a lot of the mothers spoke quite positively about their children staying within their sort of family networks. But they also spoke about the sort of guilt that they felt about that because of the financial pressure. But not just finance, sort of the pressure of time as well. And, the, you know, they said they've got their own lives. And now I've almost placed my children within their life in a complete different way to how I suppose they were in it before. So I don't want to sort of, I suppose, paint that experience in a complete...
Of course, positive
light. That it's great that, you know, those that these women had family networks and that the children were able to stay in a familiar space, but the pressures of that for the whole wider family and...
It's huge,
that ripple effect, isn't it, of imprisonment.
Yeah, and it doesn't take the guilt away. If anything, it might even make it worse.
Well, exactly. So then when we're looking on a macro scale at the system, and people might sort of think, oh, well, it's just the women. There aren't that many of them. They don't get on the roof of the prison and riot like the men do. So let's not worry about them too much because they don't make headlines very often.
And they clearly can't behave, so they're better off in there.
Exactly. And then you actually look at the societal impact of what we're doing. And actually, it wouldn't take much to build a few more Hope Streets and a few more counties. And
of course, and if we were to try to look at these women prior to their imprisonment and think about everything that they brought with them into prison, because it's not, it doesn't work in isolation. You know, if you were to take a look at their whole lives, there's a lot of violence, there's a lot of abuse, there's a lot of trauma, you know, and this could be in any form. And they then bring that into prison and it's heightened, it's magnified while inside. And then they're released with that. They then have the added element of prison, imprisonment, onto that trauma, and then they're released and we expect them to be the perfect happy person.
Exactly. Just now go and get a job and get your mental health together and just live a really happy life.
And don't ever do this again.
Yeah. Exactly. It's madness, isn't it? Great. Well, thank you both so much for talking to me. It's been absolutely fascinating.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you.
Links relevant to this episode can be found in the pod notes below. If you enjoyed listening, we would love it if you would subscribe. Also, rate, review, and best of all, share this episode. Justice is produced for One Small Thing by the London Podcast Company.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too.
That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.